Here, find a house of welcoming. Here, find vision and hope. Here, be received as you truly are, unique and beautiful. Your journey acknowledged, your love honored. Let us celebrate, let us rejoice together. Take a moment to welcome those around you on this beautiful Sunday morning. You would think, since I'm at all this time, I would have done this before. This morning is one of two services we do a year that acknowledges our welcoming congregation status. And in the spirit of that, I'd like to share part of Star King School for the Ministry's mission statement. I've adapted it for our fellowship. May our mission, theological, and philosophical vision of community support us in fostering the courage to counter oppressions. In our work, we strive to embody what we hope to see in the world, a just, loving humanity and community in which people are free to be themselves fully without fear. A community where no one is exiled, silenced, or exploited because of gender expression, race, color, ethnic or national origin, religion, sexual, affectional orientation, age, class, physical character, or disability. So in that spirit, you are welcomed into this community this morning. Come into the circle of love and justice. Come into the community of peace, holiness, and health. Come into the circle of light and hope where the uniqueness of each person may shine. Come and seek peace and joy. May the light of our chalice burn with bright promise for all. Now, as you're able, please stand and let us sing our opening hymn, Morning Has Broken, number 38.
Thank you.
Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would please share a brief verbal expression of a special joy or sorrow, now is the time to do so.
Hi, I'm Kathy Hedge. I have a sorrow that I lost one of my former student teachers, and she was homeless and died by herself, and that was very, very sad. But I also have a great joy, and that is I got to go out to California and see my son Joseph, and he sends, and his sweetheart Sam, who is a delightful woman, and they send their love to you.
Hi, everybody. Molly McGoy. Just a couple RE announcements that are the small sorrow is that there was a long weekend for the grade school kids, and I think that that made them not want to do anything because we're really short on kids today, so that's a sorrow. Sandy is out in California, and her daughter Catherine is taking the pre-K room, which is a big joy because Catherine volunteers here almost every week in the nursery and is thinking about going into elementary ed or early childhood ed, and so we're thrilled that Catherine, who is hiding preparing for her class, is willing to step up and do that kind of service for us. So if you see her, tell her thank you.
I'm Pat Embers. I want to make an announcement related to UU. There is a man in California. His name is Michael Toms. He's head of the New Dimensions Radio that has been in existence for, I think, 40 years, who died this last couple weeks. And the first show was given in the Unitarian Church, or whatever it is, in San Francisco a long time ago when it was first started. And I have followed that, and I think that's just such a great radio thought-provoking program. The other thing is that last night Ken and I were driving home from McPherson, and we heard Garrison Keillor talk a lot about the UU church or fellowship in Minnesota and had some really good historical things to say.
Hi, Amy Fowler, and I had the pleasure of doing the Crisis Center volunteer workshop the last two Saturdays. And not just that, but I actually met the president of the LGBTQ down K-State, and it was really exciting because I was wanting to get involved with that. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm Jane Pelletier. And speaking of Crisis Center, I had the pleasure of giving a portion of the Crisis Center training last Saturday on how religion relates to domestic violence. And I hope it was helpful. Amy, was it? Oh, good. Thank you. Yes. So it was a real challenge for me to prepare that. And I guess it's fairly obvious that religion, in many instances, does connect to domestic violence because of misinterpretation of scripture. And so I hope that I corrected some of those ideas.
Gene Severs, my joy or relief is that I got the castle built for Michaela and her student peers at Wamego to have the Once Upon a Mattress play. For all the emphasis on sports at Wamego exhibits, they all, I'm very relieved that they have a strong support for the band and the choir and the theater and the visual arts also.
Looking at Michael Nelson, it reminds me of what you talked about on Martin Luther King Day and what's going on in Chicago schools, and we don't read about it. There was a long report on my way to Kansas City on NPR yesterday about the situation in Chicago, so it's not that nobody cares or thinks about those kids.
And you can find that on NPR, This American Life. Yes, one more. Yes.
Yeah, I'm Wayne Clark, and it's a joy and a concern. Oh, a joy and a concern. My friend Virginia had surgery on her back, and I'll be going out there later this week for about 2 months to help take care of her.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts. And since I skipped over the announcements, I do want to draw your attention to them. And Michaela Sievers would like to invite everyone to come to see Wamego High School's musical Once Upon a Mattress this afternoon at 3 p.m. in the Wamego High School Auditorium. It's a great show.
Thank you. All right, fair. Is it on? Yes, it is. Great. I'd like to invite the children forward for our time for all ages. So come on down. Have a seat. Is that usually where you all sit, all the way up there? Great. Well, I'm just going to have a seat right here. And I guess we'll see who comes on over. So, this morning I have a story to share with you all about a boy named Andre. Now, Andre came here for church just last week for the first time. He had never, ever been to a church before, to a fellowship before. And this is actually something that, a story that I can relate to, because this is my first time in worship with you all this morning. So, Andre came here, and he came here with both of his dads, and he didn't know what to expect. It was his first time ever coming to church. So he came here, and he came in here, and he heard the choir sing, and he sang himself. And then he heard a story, and he walked down the hall to the religious education space. Now, when he got there, again, he didn't know what to expect. He had new teachers, and there were new kids here that he had never met. This is a whole new place for him. And so for the first, couple of minutes, there was a lesson, and he just sort of sat quietly. He was keeping to himself, keeping really shy. And then a friend, Brianna, came up and sat right next to him. Now, when Brianna came up and sat right next to him, what do you suppose that she said to him? Do you know? Do you have any ideas what she could have said to him? Hi. Hi is a good one. What are some other things she could have said to him? Any of the kids, any of the adults here? What are some other things she could have said to him? What is your name? That's a great idea. What is your name? Yeah, just to get to know him a little bit better. What else could she have said? Well, what she said was, hi, my name is Brianna, and I'd like to introduce myself to you and get to know you a little bit better. They sat down and they got to do a craft together. And so, has anyone here ever had this same experience of being the new person coming somewhere for the first time, being a newcomer? Yeah, no, never? You've never been a newcomer? What about like a first day of school experience? Have you ever had something like that? Where you come in and this is your first time ever being somewhere? Wasn't it important to you to feel welcomed, to feel like you were cared for there, to feel like it was good for you to be there and good, and that you were welcomed there by friends, that you were able to make friends there? So when Andre left church that day, he left feeling a couple of steps taller. He left feeling a little bit better, knowing that he had been welcomed here and knowing that he had been welcomed here in the space and knowing that he was able to make a friend, because it's important for us to show that we care for other people and that we welcome them here. That's the important piece, that we welcome them here and that people are here and that they're accepted for who they are and known for who they are. So with that, I'm going to send you off to your religious education classrooms as we all join now in singing Go Now in Peace.
To the service of evolving truth and the increase of loving kindness, we dedicate our lives and this offering. May we give so each of us might receive and share the blessing of compassion, its inclusion. This morning, as I mentioned, is a service dedicated to the Welcoming Congregation Program. The Welcoming Congregation Program is a volunteer program for Unitarian Universalist congregations that want to take intentional steps to become more welcoming and inclusive of people with marginalized sexual orientations and gender identities. First launched in 1990, the program grew out of an understanding that widespread prejudices and ignorance about lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people existed within Unitarian Universalism, which resulted in the exclusion of LGBTQ people from our congregations. We are fortunate to be among the 66% of the U.S. Unitarian Universalist congregations that have gone through this program and lifted up every year. 94% of the Canadian Unitarian Universalist associations are welcoming congregations. So obviously, amongst some of the most progressive people, there's still work to do. I would like to share a reading by a high school student by the name of Amelia. Founding my school's Gay-Straight Alliance was a long and difficult process, but it was definitely worth it. I never knew what a GSA was until I learned about them online. I thought a GSA was an awesome idea, so I did some research on what types of things to do with a GSA and how to go about creating one. In eighth grade, I asked the dean of students at my school about it. He thought it was a great idea, but he thought that it probably wouldn't be approved. He said it was too controversial or something. This got me kind of down, and I left the idea for a while. When I started ninth grade, I marched up to the principal and said that our school should have a GSA. She thought it was a great idea, but I needed to find a voluntary advisor and some people that would join the group. The subject would also have to be brought up to the school board of education. I began my search for an advisor, and I began a petition to start GSA at our school. I got a few hundred signatures, including some from teachers. Through gathering my signatures, I discovered there were a few people who didn't believe in the cause. I did some more research and created some rules for the GSA. I asked many different teachers about being an advisor. Sadly, many of them already had other obligations. I was disappointed. But then in the beginning of my 10th grade year, a woman approached me because she had heard I wanted to start a GSA at the school. She also believed that the school should have one and told me she would be glad to be an advisor. The subject was brought up at the Board of Education, and they approved it. Yes! The advisor and I began setting up a schedule and researching what other GSAs were discussing and doing. In November, after 2 long years, we officially had the GSA. Sure, we didn't get funding because we weren't an official club, but it's better than not having a GSA at all. At the meetings, I met a lot of cool people. We have a rainbow wall in one of the main hallways. There we post LGBT resources, and we have a person of the month. Yes, a person of the month. Yes, there has been some negativity about the group, but the groups are there for each other. And we offer advice, help each other, and all those negative people seem to not matter anymore. We have each other, and that's all that matters. We've gone on field trips, conferences, participated in events, and more. I love our GSA, and I'm glad I stood up and made it happen. One person can do it. One person can stand up and make it happen. Will you be that person?
Good morning. I'm so grateful this morning to be invited here to your fellowship to speak on behalf of the Welcoming Congregation program, a series of workshops and programming designed to help congregations become more inclusive of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender persons. It is an honor to come here to share about my experience of this program and to learn more about your fellowship's continued welcome of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender folks. I have a deep gratitude for the existence of this program because it is where my involvement in leadership with my home congregation began. It was the first place where my opinions and experiences were valued alongside the adults of my congregation at the age of 16. And it is the first place I got to know other adults outside of our religious education program growing up Unitarian Universalist. I see the Welcoming Congregation program as a vital beginning to creating welcoming in our churches, an aspect of community that is consistently worth interrogating and questioning. Who is welcome here? How do we create welcome? What does it mean to be a welcoming community? Like any good Unitarian Universalist, I want to question and analyze what we mean by being a welcoming congregation. See, I think it is fabulous that we have a program to intentionally welcome GLBT persons. Our consistent welcoming stance of gays and lesbians is a major key component of why I am able to stand in this pulpit and preach with you all this morning as a gay woman. I know this was not always the case in our congregations, and still is not the case in many religious communities. And I cannot take our welcoming stance of the gay community for granted. What I think is also important to question is how a program that welcomes gays and lesbians can provide a doorway for welcoming people of many different backgrounds. How this program helps us to talk about being welcoming to transgender and bisexual people as well. How this program might even help us to look at ways we can become welcoming to people of varying socioeconomic backgrounds, of varying racial backgrounds, varying levels of ability and disability. The list continues, and it should. I think stopping with gays and lesbians is extremely limiting. And I often find that in this welcome is the invitation for gays and lesbians to join our congregations, but only if they fit into certain social norms set by a particular community. I dream of a world where we can be better inclusive of people who hold identities different from our own. And it is out of this dream that I come to you this morning with a story to share. In Kansas City, where I come from and where I live now, I have the privilege of working with a fabulous group of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer teenagers. Our group is called the Phoenix Leadership Team, and it's named after the Phoenix Society, which was an early homophile or homosexual affirming group that formed in the Kansas City area. Our youth group serves as the youth advisory board to an organization called EQUAL, which stands for Empowering Queer Activists and Leaders. We are a youth and young adult-led organization that focuses on direct action and leadership development for activists in our local area. Each year for the past 3 years, we have been holding a protest at the One Thing Conference, an annual conference sponsored by the International House of Prayer. I fortunately or unfortunately don't have time to go into all the background of the International House of Prayer with you this morning. To give you the short of it, it is a conservative Christian church with a minister, Lou Engel, who has consistently spoken out against the gay community. He traveled to Uganda to speak in support of the Kill the Gays bill, some legislation that was proposed there in recent years and is on the table to be voted on again this year. His son has a missional ministry in the Castro District in San Francisco, a predominantly queer community, where he runs an ex-gay ministry. And the International House of Prayer consistently hosts programming for Desert Stream Ministries, an ex-gay reparative therapy program. The connection between Desert Stream Ministries and the International House of Prayer is not widely known about, and this is where the youth I work with came in this year. They decided that what they wanted to do was to host a die-in, a protest where we named that the International House of Prayer was promoting this ministry and where people would come forward and literally lay on the ground to represent a high school youth or a teenager who had committed suicide following participation in an ex-gay reparative therapy program. I want to lift up this aspect of the protest for just a minute with you all this morning. These youth wanted to name who had committed suicide after going through an ex-gay reparative therapy program to honor the names that we knew. The recent outpouring in our news and media of stories of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth committing suicide over the past 2 years has been overwhelming. The youth wanted to honor these people who had taken their lives and to recognize that there are still many stories of suicide and severe depression that have been left untold. There are many names that we did not even know. And the youth they named ranged in age from 11 to 17. In this die-in, our intention was to name and give a visual of the shame and the self-hatred these programs can promote. Because I honestly believe that any institution that tells a person they are wrong for being who they are cannot avoid being based in shame. It is not surprising that people come out of ex-gay reparative therapy with a much lower sense of self-worth than when they entered. And these programs embody an institution telling you you are wrong for being who you are, after you have more than likely been hearing these messages for a good portion of your life. So we protested. We named the connections between Desert Stream Ministries and the International House of Prayer. We named the corrupt intentions behind ex-gay reparative therapy. We named the first names of those young people who had committed suicide, and we prayed over the people who represented their bodies. We prayed to God to hold those who had been driven to take their own lives. We prayed for the people present who stopped to listen to us. And we prayed for ourselves. And then we invited people into conversation. The youth felt this was an especially important piece, to listen to the people who were at this conference, to inform them about what the International House of Prayer was promoting, and to be in dialogue with people who may share a different background than our own. This is the important piece, to me, of welcoming people. This was where the magic happened. Because we can come out in our own communities and talk about liberal, religious, or political views, and we can come out and we can talk at people, or we can make the decision to talk with people. At times, I worry that in our social justice efforts as a denomination, we tend to alienate more people than we draw in. We tend to assert our views as the correct view and don't want to listen to the people who disagree with us. This is where our movements become stagnant, where our congregations can get stuck, where a message of peace and social justice can be stopped right where it stands. And I want to highlight how risky it is for these youth and how risky it is for people of all ages and from all backgrounds to engage in conversations we perceive with people we perceive as having different opinions than our own and different viewpoints than our own. It's risky because people engaged in these conversations are both standing their own ground while also taking a step towards being changed, towards being transformed. As I spoke with people who were present at this conference, I found out very few of them were aware that the International House of Prayer was connected with an ex-gay reparative therapy program. And I found out that a few of the people I was talking with did not share the same views as the leaders of their organization regarding whether homosexuality was a sin. When debriefing with the youth I serve after the protest, many of us had experienced the same thing. And being in these conversations forced us to acknowledge the humanity of these people we had originally demonized. I want to take a moment here and unpack this idea for a minute with you all. Our group had come to this conference with the mission of informing people about the connections between Desert Stream Ministries, a Christian-based gay recovery program that treats homosexuality as a disease to be recovered from, and the International House of Prayer, a theologically and politically conservative religious organization. As we planned for this conference, our small group had engaged in a lot of us versus them thinking. We had a training on how to engage with people from a Christian background in conversations about homosexuality, and in our training, mostly considered how to speak to Bible passages that supposedly argue that homosexuality is a sin. In these trainings, we had demonized the people we were inviting into conversation. We had trained our group to go into combat mode with their scriptural armor on, with their defenses up, and a very narrow definition of who the human beings would be that we were engaging with. As a mentor of this group, I can now say that this was how I was framing the conversation as a leader, but it was difficult for me to see this in the moment. What I found was that some of the people I was talking to at this conference were full of love, were open to our message, and were wanting to learn more about the connections between these two organizations. I was transformed in the midst of this process because I was not expecting our common humanity to show its beautiful face in this place at this time. It was risky for me to have these conversations because I learned that there were people at this conference I had things in common with. The conversation for me became less of an us versus them frame and became more of how to build upon the common ground that we shared. Now, I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture here. There were certainly people in attendance who were ready to make arguments that homosexuality is a sin, that being gay is sexually immoral, and that these ex-gay reparative therapy programs are places of healing for all who attend them. There were folks present who were not open to our message at all, who had their feet firmly planted on one side of an argument that no one in our group was going to reach. To be honest, I believe that there were folks who attended our protest to support our cause who were engaging in the same kind of thinking. For the record, when someone's quoting a Pauline letter in support of their argument, it's rarely helpful to come back with, "Well, Paul was a misogynist and a bigot." Not really a very good conversation starter, in my experience. It is still important to draw attention to these justice issues in our community, to have conversations and hold rallies and draw attention to the fact that our dream of a world where every person's dignity and personhood is respected is far from being a reality in this country and in our global, broader community. As religious congregations, I believe we have an important role to play in efforts towards justice, towards freedom, and towards wholeness for all peoples. The driving force behind these efforts must continue to be love. Love for our neighbor, love for our communities, love for a higher power as they are known and understood in this place. It is out of that that the Welcoming Congregation program began. Love for a part of our human community we saw being alienated by many other religious denominations and by our own. Love for a people still alienated by many religious denominations and organizations. And it is out of love for our congregations and for our neighbors that we must continue to question and challenge who is welcome here. We have a saving place, a salvation in this life, in our communities, right here. We have a place of acceptance where people can go who have been cast out of other religious communities, who have never considered themselves worthy of attending church, or who have never seen the value of living a more spiritually sound, religiously informed life. We have much to give and much to receive from opening our doors a little wider, from inviting a newcomer in. May we continue to question and interrogate the welcome we are providing, knowing that questions of welcome are always complex and multi-layered. May we strive to do our best to love our neighbor as ourselves, knowing there is a common humanity which binds us all together. May we engage in those risky conversations moving forward, conversations that shine light on those commonalities between each and every one of us. And may we always remember that acts of justice and welcome are acts of love. May it be so.
So we have a good amount of time for sharing, and we would like to invite you to share those stories when you have been transformed unexpectedly and found something that was closed in you open up to the new possibilities present. So if anybody has an image, a story, a memory that they have experienced, this would be a great time to share that. When you have found yourself not wanting to welcome someone and you've been surprised at what's happened when you did.
This isn't about me, but I was going to share. I'm friends with Shane Windmeyer, who's the founder and director of Campus Pride, a college-age LGBTQ organization. And he has made the national news somewhat lately by reaching out and starting a dialogue with the CEO of Chick-fil-A. And he has actually gotten them to stop funding some of their anti-gay organizations that they've been funding. And it's been interesting to see that both he, kind of from the far left, and the Chick-fil-A CEO from the far right being criticized for the two of them talking to each other and creating a relationship where they both now say they respect each other, even though they don't agree on a lot of things. So it's good to see that dialogue.
Yep, thank you very much. That was really very good and opening. I really think that there's a huge difference between saying we're a welcoming community Mm-hmm. And then actually talking to someone when they come in. Mm. You know, I think we feel very proud of, that we can, as a group, feel very proud of ourselves. Look, our door is open. Isn't that nice? But then everybody just kind of walks and goes talks to their friends. So I would just encourage, I know I need to do this myself, too, because I'm a naturally shy person, believe it or not. Okay, so so to actually go up and actually talk in a conversation with somebody that I have no idea who they are or what their concerns are or their joys, and to make myself do that. It's not easy, but, boy, is it important.
Lane, I really appreciated your talk.
Thank you.
One of the things I notice in American society, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the training you went through with your young people, I find that the huge ravine between the opposing points of view in this country just seemed to get bigger and bigger. I had an experience in the last national election cycle where cousins would come to my house and eat at my table for many years, inform me that they were going to vote for Paul Ryan because he was going to put an end to abortion. And I said, well, do you realize that by saying that, you're telling me that you basically don't give a damn that I'm gay because mm-hmm. Paul Ryan is a homophobe? And even within my own family, I got to such a point that I just said, okay, Annie, you have your opinion, but you're no longer going to be welcome here because I don't have people who support Paul Ryan sitting down and eating at my table. Mm-hmm. And she just couldn't understand why I felt that way, because for her, you know, he was going to be the savior on the whole abortion issue, which is, you know, such a big red herring. But I couldn't get her to the point where she could understand that by voting for Paul Ryan in company, she was going to be actually be voting against her own self-interest. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we have a really hard time. As hard as I tried to communicate why I thought and felt the way I did, there just wasn't any reception on that other side. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you could share what insights you got in this context, because I always hear these talks, but I would like to see more concrete examples of what we can do every day to help bridge that communication gap.
Yeah. Well, to be honest with you, the trainings that we did were, it was really just a one-day type of a deal for 2 hours where we talked about different scriptural passages. That's what we did with the youth that we were with. What I found was helpful on the ground in the conversations that I was having was to share the commonalities that I have with people as a baseline. You know, in order to get the conversation starting, to just start to share a different commonality that we have. For me, I hold a Christian identity, and so I had a very good foundational start for that, to say, hey, you know, I'm also Christian too, let's talk about this, or I'm also religious too, let's talk about this in religious terms. I think it's interesting that you bring up abortion, because a lot in a few of the conversations that I had, folks were trying to bring that up and sort of bring that into the conversation when we were there to talk about a specific issue and not there to talk about abortion. So that was an interesting piece that you just brought up there. I think also it's important to know, you know, when you're in a conversation with folks, how far are you going to be able to get? You know, there's sort of like I went to a different training with somebody about having conversations with people about, with people from a religious background about gay issues and about GLBT issues. And he was using sort of this diagram of like a needle point, kind of like an applausometer a little bit, you know what I mean? Trying to figure out, you know, where is somebody starting from and where are we going to be able to get? You're probably not going to be able to get to the point where you convince somebody to completely abandon their whole political background in one conversation, you know, but Where are places where we can share personal stories or share personal experiences that might touch somebody else or might get them to start thinking? I think that's, you kind of have to assess how far you're going to be able to go. For me, I wasn't going to be able to stand there with somebody who believes that homosexuality is a sin and completely change their mind in this one conversation. What I could do was talk to them a little bit about why they thought that way and start to sort of analyze what was going on and with them and analyze what the background was of their their claim and to start to sort of talk about that a little bit. But, you know, also in that is being willing to risk that I may not be 100% right all of the time too, you know. And I don't believe that homosexuality is a sin, but just being able to risk knowing that I might be changed, that my mind might be changed too by some of the conversations that I had.
Jessica Sievers, I am currently a nursing student, and usually when we go into clinical settings, we are told to review the patient's chart first, find out what their, you know, reason for coming to the hospital was, usually through the ER, and then, you know, focus on how do we get that issue resolved so that they can go home. Well, this past 5 weeks, we were in mental health. And I think some great advice from our instructor was do not look at their chart first.
Hmm.
Approach them as an individual, start a conversation, find out how they're doing, ask them why they're here today, and you just go from there. And sometimes they would be entirely wrong. But then again, I was always amazed at how sound that person was at that time, and they're not much different from the students or the faculty or the workers. And I was surprised to see just how many people are coming in with PTSD or substance abuse, and they usually go hand in hand, and how many people kept coming back. One of the shocking figures I heard from the suicide prevention case manager was there at the VA, anyone who calls the crisis line, that is a woman who's a veteran, she has never seen one that hasn't been sexually assaulted. Wow. So that's kind of a tangent, but just the exercise of us as students going in to interview a person, a patient, client, however you want to call them, with a clean slate. I think that was a good learning technique for us.
Great. Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of value to speaking to people in their context or speaking to people where they are at that moment. So thank you for lifting that up.
Ann Cowan, in sort of response to Chris's question, what can you do? But I spent my career as a physical therapist working mostly in very conservative areas, especially my last job working in nursing homes. And people would say things that I totally disagreed with, and it was not my place to rile up the situation, so I would have to sort of bite my tongue. But I worked very hard at finding some comment that they would agree with me that might sort of point out something that they would think about later. Like if they said something against homosexuals, I might say, and isn't it sad the teenagers that are killing themselves over this? Mm. Or the 11-year-old that, you know, is so depressed, you know, and then just leave it at that. Because I agree with them. I mean, I didn't disagree with them. I just pointed out something that maybe they would agree with, that is sad.
Mm-hmm. That is. That's a good idea.
My name is Barry Peterson. I know a lot of you don't know me, and I sometimes get very nervous about standing up and talking to people who, you know, I don't know and you don't know, and it's kind of a question. As you may know, I spent a long time being a guidance counselor and doing various kinds of counseling with various people. And I had an experience last night which was very interesting because I still am basically a voyeurist. I love to listen to people's stories. Whatever you tell me, you know, I'm engrossed. I'm really interested. And I think that, you know, that's an occupational hazard that I'm going to live with my whole life. But I was really interested in your metaphor of the needle moving from one side to another. Okay. Because in my conference or my talk with this woman that I had known for some time, I really saw that needle moving as it moved, you know, the whole society moves about these issues. She's a woman who spent 25 years married to a man who finally decided that he was gay. He requested the divorce. He got the divorce. He got the custody of the children, which was very unusual. And the reason he got the custody is because she moved away from the domicile before he did, and he was able to get a better lawyer than she was able to get. But she has gone through several lawsuits with this situation, trying to get custody back, has not been able to do it. And last night she was in a very, very upset state because she had just gotten a letter from the attorney saying that she was not going to have custody of her children. And she was terrified because she is a Christian, a very conservative Christian, and she's afraid that her children are going to go straight to hell. So she's very, very upset. And I watched her as she was wrestling with all of these issues. And my thoughts were, you know, the whole society is wrestling with these issues. It isn't just this particular family. But she's having to wrestle with, you know, what do I do about my feelings? What do I do about my children's feelings? And then she, while we were talking, got an email from her son, who had gone to an awakening session of some kind, and he had worn a big T-shirt that said Trojan across it, and he was passing out condoms to the homosexual crowd that was there. And this really broke her up. You know, she could hardly talk about this. And yet she had to realize somehow that she had to go on with her own life, and she had to wrestle with, you know, the fact that people are really dealing with this on a very personal level. It isn't just a societal level, but families break up, issues happen, and that more people, I think, need to hear stories about the pain that is caused by not understanding that people are different, that people do have different goals, different expectations about their lives. It was really a very heart-rending experience. We were up until around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning this morning discussing this. And I was just really feeling sad, both for her case and for the case that many, many people are suffering because of the misunderstandings about who people are, what our expectations are about life roles, about issues. There's just a lot to be dealt with, and I think that perhaps we as a congregation or we as a group will find ourselves listening, hoping, caring about people's concerns as they move across that needle, as they move across that continuum. It's tough. It's really tough.
It is. And it's complex. It's very complex.
On the subject of finding common agreement with, you know, people who don't agree with you, you're never going to convince anybody, some people, that homosexuality is a sin. So that might not be, you know, a worthy topic to follow. But what about the idea that so-called restorative efforts work? Mm-hmm. I mean, I assume it's well documented that they don't work.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Is that something that you can convince anybody of who needs convincing?
Well, I think it's lifting up, that part of that is lifting up stories of folks who have gone through those programs where it hasn't worked. What was interesting, the protest that we were at, somebody actually came to the protest where ex-gay reparative therapy had been a success for them and wanted to come and share their story. And so some people were there listening and other people really weren't interested in listening to this person at all. They wanted to just sort of talk at him instead of talking with him some more. And there has been a lot of documentation around ex-gay reparative therapy not working and not really being that helpful. I think there was some legislation that was recently passed in California outlawing it for folks who are under the age of 18. A lot of that is just sharing people's stories. And so what we did during the protest was one of our youth had collected together a bunch of stories, and they shared a few from people's experiences of going through different reparative therapy programs and different reparative therapy tactics. And I think just sharing that there are people who are continually, you know, committing suicide or who are depressed afterwards or who, you know, sort of waver in and out of the closet afterwards and just leave with an overall sense of shame around their own sexual identity. I think also what's important in those conversations is aspects of choice. Who's choosing to engage in these programs? Because there are people who willfully choose to engage in ex-gay reparative therapy. And for them, that is their decision. You know, that feels like the right path for them. Now, when it's not your choice, when it's, you know, somebody... It's when it's parents asking children to go through a program, or when it's a relative or a guardian asking children to go through these programs, the aspect of choice becomes very complicated and complex. It's not often their choice to go through those programs. And I think that that's where we really wanted to start the conversation and have the conversation, is who has a choice to go into these programs if that's something that they want to do. So
And I just might add that many of the people who started the ex-gay therapies have recanted and, you know, rejoined their identity as a LGBT person. So that's happened over and over again. And it really is, if you look at it, it's a system of torture.
Yeah, we just had that happen with Exodus Ministries. They just stopped.
Michael. I'll change the names, but I'll be honest about the date. It was 1956, and I was a sophomore in high school, and a senior who was also on the basketball team, and unlike me, a bench warmer, he was a star. Somebody I liked and respected told me about a rescue mission that he had recently been on. He went to the movies and saw that two people, what do we call them, Ron and Sally, had come in together. And watched for an opportunity to, when Ron went to the bathroom, to warn Sally that Ron was gay. Mm. Now, and he told me about this, and I wish I'd been a little more forceful in my response, but I thought, well, what does Sally have to worry about from Ron? she's probably safer with him than she would have been with the boy telling me about the event, but it was the first time I ever was aware of this kind of. Well, I have to tell you, it struck me as first of all silly, and also contrary to my sense of justice and fair play. And so I'm thinking about what it was in my parents that must have planted the seeds of this, and it was things like my mother's comment, well, if you just know where somebody goes to church, you don't know much about that person. Mm. And other things like that. And while they were not radically liberal people at all, they were fair-minded. I think there is a place to go with appealing to fair-mindedness when it comes to treatment of people who are a little bit different or maybe a lot different. And I don't know how to put it into action. I hope I've done it with my own kids and with students when I had the chance. But it is, I'm not saying I'm proud of myself. I just, it just seemed so odd to take this position. And I then heard other stories about, you know, picking up somebody who was gay and then beating them up. And I said, well, you know, how does that, you know, what is the rationale for doing anything like this? But it continues, and it continues, unfortunately. I think it's better than it once was. I mean, you know, being part of the straight community, I think I hear less verbal and vocal complaining than I did when I was a kid.
Well, and the importance, I think, of starting the conversation at home, that's a great piece to bring up, to start the conversation at home and to start the conversation in our religious communities. I mean, this is where our kids are learning. This is where children are learning. And also, as parents, I think it's very important to pass that knowledge on and to have those conversations, because I think a lot of gay bashing comes out of fear and anxiety around sexual orientation. So if we are continually talking with children and trying to diffuse some of that shame so we can alleviate some of that fear, I think that's a great place to start.
Sarah.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a story that I mentioned in the Deepening Understanding of UU session last week, and that is that when I signed up for a guide to personal success mentorship program on campus 2 years ago to be a mentor to an incoming freshman, in the comment section where it says, is there anything else we should know about you and what you have to offer as a member, I put LGBT friendly. And so I was, you know, prepared for that. And I thought, well, if my mentee is gay, then I have something to offer. And so what I was surprised by, though, was that then the mentee I was assigned wrote on his thing that she was transgender, and I had never been there before, you know? And so it was one of these processes that you were talking about how do you go even further in walking the walk and being truly welcoming. And since then, he's begun to transition and changed his name and is on campus and out and hadn't been in high school, so this all happened at K-State, and has become someone whom I'm just so proud of. And it's been a great experience.
I just have a small thing to add. I was aware of people being gay when I was in high school because I was in an all-girls high school. And there was a big scandal, you know. Someone was calling someone the L word, and I had no idea what they meant by the L word, you know. And I remember thinking when I found out, well, yeah, so what? I mean, people are different. And 10 years later, when I was living in Boston, I had a lot of, in fact, I had fallen in love with a gay man. We had fallen in love with each other, but of course, you know, nothing happened. And it was sad for both of us, but it was okay. You know, it was part of my education. And then not long after that, my brother came to town and came out to me, and we had a long conversation, and I said, but you had girlfriends in high school, right? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, well, I mean, this is my naive self. In the 1960s, I was in my 20s, I knew a lot of gay guys that were my friends, but I still hadn't been educated by anyone or by any, you know, there was no information out there. Nobody was talking about it. And I kind of thought, well, I mean, can't people just choose? Don't they just choose? So I really believed that. So I can understand when you're talking about the spectrum and the needle going from one to the other, because I've gone through all that and I have come to the realization that my brother had to go to a psychologist because he was gay. In the 1980s, believe it or not, and this psychologist actually believed that this was a disease, and it was a horrible experience for him. So, I mean, I've gone from, you know, thinking that people could choose their, you know, gender orientation to realizing, and it's been a long time. That's taken me there, 50 years to get there, so...
We have time for one more. Stacy had her hand up.
Did he call on someone? Okay, sorry, Diane. Sorry, I don't want to have to fight you for it. I was raised in a very conservative, far-right, Christian, Southern Baptist family in West Texas. And what I can tell you is that in all the years that we would go to church, you know, like 5 days out of seven, you know, we would be, you know, taken out places and sort of expected to sing our little songs and do, you know, vacation Bible schools and all of that. And I was not exposed to the gay community. I was not exposed to very many people of other colors or other backgrounds. And, you know, I was just a product of my upbringing, and I was not a bad person. The only way that I started to have some change in some of my thoughts was by meeting people of other cultures and meeting people in other communities, and they did engage me in conversations. And they didn't try to convert me by preaching at me. What they did was they gave me a chance to see who they were on the inside. And it was slowly by getting to know these people, I started to realize that we are all the same. You know, my father still is one of those people that believes, well, it's this way because the Bible says it's so. And if I, you know, didn't have dinner with him because he wanted to vote a different way, well, I would really be lonely when I went home for dinner, you know? I wouldn't be able to be with any of my family. But it doesn't mean they're bad people. And when we find our common ground,
then our family becomes closer and we start to become more open to one another's ideas. And that was my awakening. The first time, some of you know this, I am in recovery, and the first person who ever gave me a recovery medallion was a gentleman in El Paso, Texas, who was gay and dying of AIDS. Mm. And this was in the 80s. And that's when I learned then that, you know, his gayness was not going to infect me, and neither was his AIDS status. You know, but he opened his arms to me. And if I can open my arms to some people that have different ideas, different appearances, then maybe they can learn little by little, like I did, and we can both become more loving and understanding.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the wonderful sharing. Thank you, Wayne. You want to stand up here and sing with me?
Choir worked on it ahead of time, and it's not an easy thing. But because it's in 5/4 time, and we have five fingers, so we ought to be able to count five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How do we want to put that in? But you can get five beats. But to help us out, the pianist, Renee, is going to hold the last note before we come in. Each time. And so, like when we get at the end of the first chorus at the bottom of page 3, you know, just slip over to the next page, and when she hits the note, hangs on to it, then we go to the second verse, and so on. Good luck to us all.
Thank you.
are thankful today for Lane bringing us the promise of common ground. I share these closing words with Walt Whitman. One thought ever at the fore, that in the divine ship, the world breasting time and space, all people of the globe together sail the same voyage, are bound to the same destination. Go in peace and in love.